Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today we're going to, surprising though it might seem, discuss Orthodox Nationalism. We're going to talk about somebody that I've been putting off for a long time, who I've been reading for many, many years, who's only now just making a very small dent in the English language world, and that is the great exile writer, Gulag survivor, Ivan Solonovich, who died in Latin America in 1953. He is one of the first, if not the first, to popularize the genre that would later make Solzhenitsyn famous, because he wrote Russia in a concentration camp. Sometimes it gets translated Russia in Chains, but it's a description of his first year, the Gulag, and it has a very similar feel to, of course, Solzhenitsyn's much longer and larger work. And there's no doubt in my mind that Solonovich, to a great extent, influenced Solzhenitsyn because of the intense pressure that that kind of life puts on the mind. To read what someone who survived it has to say about anything is extremely important. Some of you know I also have a article on the Ukrainian Solzhenitsyn, Vasil Stus, that will also, I believe, is the last chapter in my latest book on USSR. And speaking of which, as always, I request your financial assistance, at least until the IRS is off my back. That's not an enemy I wanted to have, but I refuse to take out any kind of tax exemption or anything like that. But what I'm going to do is that donors, if more substantial donors, I'm going to send a free copy of that book. Now, I'm going to send you the doc file. I can send you a PDF if you want. It's not quite completed, so I'm going to ask you that you don't quote it or circulate it. It's readable, certainly, and it's a clean draft, but I still have to go through it a couple more times and fix different, you know, typos and things that I really hate doing. I'm prone to a lot of typos and kind of sloppy citations, stuff like that, really only because it's a pain. And it really takes the joy out of writing. You know, read an academic book from 100 years ago. The same kind of material, the same sort of arguments, like 10 footnotes in the whole thing. And they only cite quotes. And half the time, they kind of, well, go look it up if you think I'm lying, kind of an attitude about it all. Today, an academic paper, normally, especially in your flagship journals like Political Theory, the citation page is longer than the article. There is no such thing as a sentence that doesn't have a citation. And it's getting ridiculous. It's getting cluttered. It's getting stupid. And really what it comes down to is academics being academics. They want to see their name. One thing about the academic lifestyle, one that I've shared since for 21 years now, I've been doing this professionally for, well, I started, I should say, 28 years ago, but 20 years total as a professional, is that we don't care much about money. I personally grew up in an upper middle class home. My father was a business owner, as some of you know. Money never really impressed me, largely because it you know, rips families apart, my own included. Unfortunately, money is the only thing that pays bills and debts and things like that. Nevertheless, academics see success not as income, but as influence, incitations, and your reputation as a scholar. And that's really what success is. So, you know, we really don't care that much about money. Money's nice, but that's a distant second to the real reason that you get into this field or any field like this at all. And that is to matter. For me, it's the ultimate form of activism. Now, in the case of Solonovich, his activism really came out of necessity. He fought with the white armies during the Civil War, and he was a bodybuilder. And in fact, there's a few pictures I have of him that are just, he's bigger than guys that era used to be. I don't know what they did to them over there. But he looks like Arnold looked like 30 years ago, which at the time, you didn't really see in the West. He was like Ivan Drago. You know, he was chiseled in a way that Western bodybuilders never were. Now, I don't know if they were using different techniques or they were using drugs or whatever, but you could look at a picture of Ivan Solonovich from 1935, and it looks just like a bodybuilder today, which is incredible. It's unheard of. Drugs may have been involved. Point I'm trying to make here is that one of the reasons that he was tolerated for a while in the USSR was for that reason. As an accomplished bodybuilder and a trainer, he was really good at what he did. Of course, he continued to write and edit under pseudonym, and he assisted the white underground well into the 30s, right up to the German invasion, practically, both in Russia and in Ukraine. So he kept his head down while he, you know, essentially was a coach and trainer for various sports. Of course, the bodybuilder for the Russian team, and training wrestlers and things like that. Stuff that the Soviet Union always did very well in. And I think that kind of was his ticket for a while. But he had to leave. He saw too much. He knew too much. He couldn't handle what he saw. And he simply couldn't work for them anymore. And this was a non-political kind of work. But he couldn't do it anymore. And so three times he attempted to escape the country. The first time got him sentenced to 8 years in a camp, in a gulag camp. The second time was an attempt to escape from that, which failed. That got him sent to a worse camp. The third time succeeded. And he had to always keep moving. In the sporting world, he was someone of a big name at the time, and it was kind of a high-profile defection. So he lived all over the planet. He lived in Finland for a while. He lived in Germany. He lived in almost every country in Latin America, there being a very large Russian diaspora in places like Chile and Argentina. And I believe that he thought that he had to be on the run all the time. In that world, in the bodybuilding world in Eastern Europe at the time, he was a big deal, having him defect. I believe one of the first major defectors in sport that got front page treatment. But he was a political philosopher. He's a political philosopher that was forced into this field, like so many of us, because of external circumstances. None of us voluntarily become political theorists. I made that decision in 1989. And trust me, I'd rather do other things. I'd rather make more money. But the fact remains is that this is thrust upon us. We live in a demented, bizarro world. And therefore, if we are spared the brainwashing somehow, it then falls to us to try to deprogram others. What we do, the Orthodox Nationalists, the Russian Orthodox Medievalists, my website, is a sense of deprogram. We take each assumption that the Western liberal world forces on people. This is how, you know, we're born and raised. You can't escape it. You can be deprogrammed from it, but you cannot escape it. And we take each one in different contexts, economic, social, theological, whatever. And we show how absurd it is. For me, it took many years to get to the point where I'm fluid enough in the concepts that I can simply take apart any modern argument based on the assumptions that usually my opponent doesn't know he's making. The modern world implies a certain level of conditioning. The assumptions that a modern supporter of the Enlightenment, which we certainly are not here, have to engage in so many mental gymnastics to make their system work out. The reason it seems to work today, well, there's a few reasons. We're born and raised in it, so it seems second nature. The technological miracles give it a certain level of significance, although that is not a sustainable element. The system simply, that grid cannot hold for much longer. Debt alone will destroy it. People simply don't know how to get ahead of it. How many times have I heard, have you heard someone say, I know the system's rotten, but what do we replace it with? And who's going to do the replacing? And often it's because these people don't know that there are alternatives. Believe it or not, there was a time before the modern state and modern capitalism and modern, you know, nominalism and secularism. Shockingly enough, this actually existed at one time, and I dare say people were happier then than they are now. I mean, anybody is happier than today. You know, try to get an appointment at a psychiatrist's office. Americans function because they are drowning, swimming in drugs, both legal and illegal. The legalization of drugs that's been pushed for a long time is little more than corporate capital wanting to crash in and cash in on this market. It's been a while, but George Soros and others, you know, want to be able to farm and market marijuana, and God knows what else they'll put in it, just like any other commodity. And they'll go on from there. It's really hard to promote that with heroin today. Much easier to do it with marijuana. But the goal, of course, is a completely drugged up population. Or if that's not the goal, that's certainly the consequence. That's what happened. So the concept is the consciousness itself is administered by capital. The power that we're talking about here, where consciousness itself is being mediated. You know, consciousness is immediate. You immediately have a connection with it. Is itself being altered and mediated through corporate capital in the pharmaceutical industry. But just as powerfully is hypnosis. To be hypnotic is to be drawn into this web of assumptions, this ideological network that most people couldn't describe if they were asked. It's simply in the air. It informs every statement they make. Now, I'm happy to say, some of you know this too, is that the hypnotics are awakening in many areas. Of course, that's a good thing, but it's not an unmitigated good. People who have just woken up from this slumber are in no position to teach others. I know it's exciting. I know it's like a new world has opened up. But you need to take a little bit of a while. You need to get your education together. You need to get your reading list together. You need to find a specialization, something you really can focus on, something you really love. Or maybe teaching isn't for you at all. There's other things you can do. We need Indians too. The nationalist movement in America has very, very few real academics. And zero in political theory. Sam Francis, I believe, was one. Dr. Hill from League of the South is an excellent historian. You know, there's a handful of others. There's a few pretending to be academics. But even, you know, Kevin McDonald has a highly specialized field connected with Enlightenment ideology. He does a lot of good work, but he's not a counter-revolutionary in the sense that we in the church see it. I just don't know how that guy has survived. I don't know how you could function in academia. I mean, I know it. I mean, he's genuine and everything, but it's a tough life. So, and that's something else I want to say to people. You know, if this is new to you, understand that it's not an easy life. It's not a life I would wish on anyone. You see the system is struggling now. You see the system has no hope of getting out of this depression. The lying and manipulation is more and more falling apart thanks to the internet, thanks to things like WikiLeaks and you know, bits and pieces there are starting to collapse. The dam is, it kind of reminds me of the Soviet Union in the 1970s. People support the system because this is where their money is coming from, not because I have any stake in it philosophically or religiously. You know, all the excitement, the profits have long since gone from the system, except for a tiny handful. I think the 1970s USSR is actually a pretty good parallel. There are very few people who are willing to defend the present postmodern capitalist system. I mean, I guess they're out there. I don't envy their job. But there's very few people who defend this system. And then others, you see this with these military idiots sometimes. They use abstractions. And they cover up their complete lack of knowledge in anything with, you know, militant sounding, often loud threats against, you know, Arabs or whatever. That's pretty much what they have. But nationalism is intellectually and politically almost non-existent. Our people are marginalized. We're aware that if we are thrown in prison for no reason at all, of course that's illegal, but no one's going to come to our defense. And this is something that we have to go knowingly. And that's why we're talking about someone like Solonovich or Solzhenitsyn or Vasil Stus, because all these guys are in that condition. I think the situation there was better only in the sense that you had a more healthy population. You had a huge Orthodox nationalist underground in Belarus and Russia and Georgia and everywhere else, Ukraine especially. Very healthy, very ethnically and religiously oriented. There really wasn't a distinction between those two things. And the family remained the foundation. We don't have that. We have very few resources. On the other hand, anybody who is successful in this society, he's got to be pretty sick. Or at least whatever it is that they may do that they become financially successful, they realize, well, wait a minute, the vices that you need to become successful here are not moral. Unfortunately, we're forced into, but others, in order to make a living and function, they have to don this persona, and I know that they don't like it. Giving me some of that money actually might relieve your conscience just a little bit. Anyway, Ivan Solonovich, like any monarchist, His major book was People's Monarchy, the Popular Monarchy, whatever you want to call it. Like most royalists, starts with the idea that man is irrational. All Enlightenment political theories start with the opposite idea. The proposition that man is rational. People usually laugh when you say that to them. People chuckle because they know it isn't true. They could, on their drive home, they'll see it, you know, collapsing everywhere. I said this many times before, but the modern world, and this, you know, 2018 modern world, postmodern world, has a bit of a problem. Psychology as a field has done some good work in showing that reason, rationality, is about the last thing that people employ when it comes to understanding their self-interest or the world as a whole. And yet the system, the mythology of both free markets and liberal democracy is that people are firmly rational. They know their interests and know how to go about getting it. And even if for a specific period of time that fails, over time, more rational heads will take over and solve those kind of errors. That was James Madison's understanding. The crown, and I want to be very careful here. I've said this in the past, that the crown is not the state. We'll get to that more in a minute. But I'm choosing my words carefully here. The crown is the royal house. It is extremely representative. The very institution of the crown is to display all areas in historical epics of the country, actually on the royal person. And you see the official shields and everything else has the different regions of the country. I mean, it is a icon of unity. It's not irrational, but it certainly is subrational. It's a symbol in the true sense of the word. It's a gateway into something far larger. The crown is a religious, not a political institution. Political, as I've said before, has to do, well, with two things. The first is the bad stuff, the campaigns, elections, and voting, all the crap that really the church can't get involved in, can't get its hands dirty with that kind of thing. But the other thing it is theorizing about justice and truth. That is equally political. The crown, therefore, is not a political institution in that sense. It is a political institution in the sense that it manifests a very specific element of justice and natural law that a specific group of people has learned to understand. The key fact is these are all universal truths. It would be natural law, orthodoxy, whatever it is. But those are just words on a page. How it is communicated to us is another matter entirely. That's where the ethnic group comes in. That's where the historical development comes in. You know, if you're in a Russian Orthodox Church or if you're in a Ukrainian Orthodox Church, those of you who know what I'm talking about, you know precisely the minute you walk in the door. You don't have to see anybody. You don't have to hear anybody. You know precisely what church you're in. There's a million aesthetic and architectural things to tell the difference. And if you know, you realize that all of those distinctions, which would be, you know, fall on deaf ears for the average American, talk about very deep and profound historical differences over the years. That doesn't mean the faith isn't the same. The faith is identical. But they're two very, very, very different places. And they reflect a very different historical experience. So talking about words on a page, you know, doctrine and canon law, that's nice. But the faith isn't, you know, going through a checklist of things. So I agree with all these. Good, I'm going to heaven. Which, quite frankly, is, you know, what I always had thought as a young Roman Catholic. You know, I get the checklist. Good, went to confession, got the milk bottle cleaned. That's it. I'm good. And that's how a lot of, you know, Roman Catholics many years ago were taught. Very legal, very rational, very mechanistic. And it had the advantage of being very easy to understand. I always thought that's why Islam always did so well. Other than the whole, you know, violence thing. That it was a very simple system. And that anyone could understand. So when Solonovich says the crown isn't political, what he means is political in the bad sense. The crown is not concerned with factions or parties or elections or what happens at the local level. So that's not it. You know, we all need the same things at that level. Now, the crown deals with natural law as it's manifest in the specific history of a people. So it's both extremely general and extremely specific, which also is Hegel's doctrine of the monarchy. It's a tremendous, brilliant synthesis of that. More practically, though, Solonovich supports the crown because it permits long reigns and therefore long-term planning. Russia was really lucky in the 19th century. You had very long reigns, very stable individual, motivated individuals, sitting on the throne from Alexander I straight to Nicholas II. Long reigns, but also a long-range program that worked itself out over time. Russia is very lucky in that respect. There was a little hiccup with the Decembrists, but they are of no meaning. Oh, speaking of which, the Decembrists were a noble coup. As Nicholas I was coming to power, the oligarchs, the noble class, sought to foment a revolution of the rich in the elite guards in Petersburg. It took about 10 minutes to crush it. It was more symbolic than anything else. And Westerners, when they're trying to find the liberal in everything, try to point to that. And they don't like it when you say, by the way, these were very spoiled, rich kids who were promised all kinds of things if it was successful. And of course, Masonic lodges. I mean, even, most mainstream historians will talk about the immense power of the Masonic lodges in urban Russia. That once the nobles, the old noble class, was increasingly useless. Slonovich despises them, and he was very influential in my mind there. You had great noble families, you had great noble movements and ideas. There is no doubt about it. Everyone knows that there is a legitimate role for aristocracy. Russia really struggled with it, though, and Russian history can be reduced to a constant war between the common good, represented by the monarchy, and republicanism, or the specific good, oligarchy, represented by the nobles. My very first book, which came out many years ago, The Third Rome, is essentially that concept, very briefly summarized over the different royal houses of Russian history. It's really, that's the central thesis of it. He also suggests that the crown is inherently distributivist, which comes from the Old Testament. That doctrine, and a lot of Roman Catholics are aware of it from Chesterton and others, the notion that we actually take private property seriously. In capitalism, the goal is for a handful of oligarchs to control everything. That's what happens when you defeat your competition. That's what's supposed to happen. I mean, eventually, you're going to have a handful of people left. When Herbert Spencer took over the Darwinian idea and made it popular in Britain, that's what he said. The purpose of competition is to destroy itself and have a tiny oligarchy left. And they're justified because they're the ones who succeeded. It's not really a difficult theory, but can you imagine if you were a British industrialist and colonialist in the 1850s and 60s? You're destroying your competition, you're taking over entire countries, and all of a sudden you hear about this theory that says, wait a minute, what you're doing is perfectly normal and natural. Because all human history, or all natural history is, our species fighting it out for scarce resources. And they have to adapt physically and mentally to gain access to these resources. And those that do it best and with the greatest level of efficiency will destroy the others. And then, in the process, take their resources and, or in our case, their capital and markets. That was music to their ears. Oh my God, we don't have to feel guilty anymore. We take over entire continents from London. Well, that's not a bad thing. That's no different than a lion eating a gazelle in the savannah. We're just doing what human nature tells us to do. This is the reason why Darwinism dominated so fast and why it just blew away its competition in the middle of the 19th century. This is why it got the ear of every elite, industrialist or colonial exploiter in the British Empire. It justified everything that Britain was. Britain didn't win this empire because it was so large or because it had so many people. No, they won the empire because of their scientific establishment, the technology that they developed that allowed them to defeat the Spanish Armada and change the course of history forever. it was adaptation, not brute force, that led to Britain becoming the lord of the seas, for better or for worse. By the way, for the worse. But still, it was technology. It was this intellectual adaptation. Now, you can't hear a discussion on marketing, for example, that ridiculous field, discussion on marketing where they don't use those very same term. Adaptation. Efficiency. They use very abstract terms because, well, they know they're talking about actual people, and they're talking about pushing a product on people who can't afford it. Nevertheless, it's the exact same terminology. Charles Darwin he certainly had an agenda. His father most certainly had an agenda. But I don't think we would have heard much about him if Herbert Spencer didn't get a ton of money from the Royal Society and others and take that doctrine and apply it to social and economic life. So the tiny little country of Great Britain has earned the domination it has over the globe because it can adapt to changing circumstances far better than the Spanish or the Russians or the African or whatever. And it's not even a matter of morality. This is how it is. You have four general ideas in Solonovich's political theory. And these, of course, are all means whereby the Spencerian idea can be challenged. Number one, there is a very tight relationship between the church and the family. The parish or the monastery would remind you very much of a family. I mean, a parish comes into existence because a village begins to develop, attracts more people, they need a church of their own. They elect, the tradition up until Peter the Great, they elect one of their own as priests, send them to the seminary. And the church then is the very center of everything. Every aspect of human life has some religious significance. The connection between church and family or church and village is absolutely so tightly connected. There are very few things so close. Number two. Institutions are the problem. Institutions, these things that require bureaucracy and money to operate, that are based on for rationality, standardization, policy, these are the destroyers. The larger and more powerful the institution, the more damage that's done to the idea that the institution is supposed to manifest. It's not an accident that Orthodox people hate bureaucracy. There is very little of it. Even mid-19th century Russia, you know, bishops were they had very few assistants. They were wildly overworked. They had these huge sprawling dioceses. And, of course, almost no money because there was, you know, church wasn't allowed to own land then. That was owned by the state, and they were put on a salary. Even Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, even took their candle money and promised them a subsidy in return, which was not very much. So the church didn't own very much at the time. And this is one of the reasons that the church was waning in significance. Number three, as far as institutions are concerned, republics require larger state than monarchies. Republics require, they usually pass more laws. They have all these factions they have to reconcile. So, you know, everything's done in secret committees and everything else, and so that no one really knows anything about. And this is where the size of the state, bureaucracies and republics, are larger than that of monarchy. And finally, number four, political laws are never absolute. They're compromises. Natural law, of course, is, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the day-to-day law that you go to court about. Those are never absolute. That's why the crown, at least in certain circumstances, has to be above the law. He has to be able to say, wait a minute, no, in this case, it doesn't apply. Again, Russia is very lucky in that respect. Both Alexander III and his son, Nicholas II, canceled debts all over the place. And the creditors, well, too bad. You guys are doing well. The economy can't function unless these debts are canceled. One of the reasons that the capitalist class really hates monarchy. In America, of course, we need these debts simply canceled. The American taxpayer has been bled to pay off the big banks and subsidize their operations. It's time for all of these loans to simply be repudiated. But in the Orthodox world, this was not uncommon. In this particular case, we're talking about when the serfs were freed from the patrician system. They insisted, of course, that noble land be purchased, below market. And then the peasantry would then pay the state back. That was the plan. And these were called redemption payments. And they were actually very, very low. But whenever the economy took a little bit of a dip, and the Russian economy was very stable compared to others because of the currency being controlled by the state and being almost entirely self-sufficient, it became a problem. And Alexander III, and very early in the reign of Tsar Nicholas, simply canceled these debts. Too bad, you guys will live. Economics is not an absolute science in this, very much in the same spirit of this concept here. There are a few things, though, that as principles are very close to being absolute, at least in specific cases, specific national history. And one of those is that peasant landowning is inviolable. It cannot be touched. I don't care how much he owes. I don't care, the peasant's connection to the land is a sacred bond. Peasant families working that land, literally the bones of his ancestors are right there that he's working on. When I read about how nobles coming in from the cities, talking to peasants, and how they were absolutely blown away by the fact that these peasants could talk to animals, the natural order wasn't this hostile force to them. That the natural order itself was like a person that they could communicate with. And they knew every square inch of their land and the region. There's nothing these people can't do. And for somebody born and raised in a city who had very little knowledge of this, these people were mystified. It's like they were magicians. But that's what an agrarian society is. In the West, of course, is simply mechanized. And the water is disappearing. In the Midwest, is going to be a desert in a few years. The water table, when I was at the University of Nebraska, was going down a foot a year in the mid-90s. The agribusiness, and the chemicals and everything else, is destroying not just the soil and the water table, but the very nutrients in the plants themselves. Again, this is the result of standardization, having these massive fields all growing one thing, because that doesn't exactly exist in a normal natural development. One of the crowns, one of the monarchy's great victories in Russia, and one of its great responsibilities, is to fight for the interests of the peasant class, whether they be private landowners or part of a commune. The Russian peasants owned 97, not quite 98%, of Russian farmland by 1900. There was very little inequality. You had what we call middle-class peasants and poor peasants, but there wasn't a whole lot of variation. The variation that existed occurred with individual plot owners who could, hire help and things like that. But the concept of the commune, which is essential to the Russian identity, is not just collective ownership, although they owned their own specific plots. It was also to take care of those who couldn't work for some reason. Someone's husband is killed in a war. She never had to worry because the commune had, 100 able-bodied men. And they found a way. And this is how Russia has gotten through some of its, Slonovich calls Russia the great survivor, the greatest survivor of all time. Having been through what it's been through and still growing, and even today, 2018, growing in population. Some of you may remember, but in 1992, 93, the global media was writing Russia off permanently. I remember the videos. I remember reading about it. Russia has now decayed. It's beyond help. that ethnic group is just finished. You know, their life expectancy is under 60. Oh, well. And I remember being outraged by this. How come this isn't causing more people to be upset? Of course, I was the first one. Volunteer, I'll run over. I'll make babies over there. I'll do it. I'll sacrifice that. I'll do it. If you need me, I'll do it. I never got a call back for some reason. But, you know, this was, I never heard of this happening before. This is all peacetime. There was no war going on. A country simply imploded and collapsed from within. We know that it had help. But it was, you know, 28 years ago or so, Russia was being written off. I still have some of the newspaper articles that I read in the Times. And there was a bit of undisguised glee about the whole thing. But then Putin happened. The Christian economy is one of the essential elements in Slonovich's thought. And I've hinted at it, the anti-noble element. This is one of the most powerful contributions that Slonovich makes. That's the crown's big job, as we say, to protect the peasantry. That is to say, to protect landowners, which are small landowners. There was never any tolerance for massive inequalities. There was only tolerance for how much you could actually work for and earn. There were always very, very strict laws on usury, although at the local level it's very difficult to enforce. But the Jews in Western Russia, as Derzhov and others had pointed out, you know, are creating this oligarchy from peasant landowners who were, you know, were shrewd people. But they weren't as the Jews were when it came to manipulating others. The fight against nobility, it's not just this titled class. The nobility is any oligarchy. Russian history, and actually most European history, the noble property owners, it doesn't matter if they had a title or not, noble property owners will do anything to maintain what they have. They'll become traitors. They will convert to another religion. They will do anything. You know, in Ireland, the British solidified their rule by going to the O'Neills and others in Ulster saying, we will give you a better title to this land. We will give you a new English name. We will give you an empire to defend your holdings. All you got to do is turn in a couple of these rebels. And it was really hard to say no. This is what noble property classes do. Their entire world revolves around money and wealth and reputation, what others think of them, their manhood, what women think of them. This is what they're concerned with. And it's such a powerful, overwhelming urge. And some of us have felt this ourselves. No one's innocent of that. I mean, we're normal, sinful people. But it's a drive that is overwhelming. And when you are born and raised into this class, and you are taught that this is a sine qua non of your existence, well, there has to be force from the outside to persuade you that your own income is not the sine qua non of social life. Remember, and Slonovich makes a big deal about this. It's also something that that has to be understood with him, and that he was the first in the, you know, the immigrant community to say that under Ivan the Terrible, Ivan the Fourth, the national army was tiny by comparison to the local noble armies. These were states within states. Remember, we're talking about pre-modern empires. These aren't countries. These are independent confederations of regions without clear borders, bound together in the Russian case by ethnicity and religion. But it is not a formal bureaucratic apparatus. That's the difference between this pre-modern empire and a country. Much of Slonovich's writing centers around the concept of an empire, both pre-modern and modern, the differences between nations and empires. Of course, nations and empires have very little in common other than being political forms. He calls it really the philosophy of the fields. It developed these institutions through struggle. The early 90s is being the most recent one. An empire is a collection of otherwise independent ethnic groups and regions. It does not directly rule over them. It collects taxes. It provides a single currency. It provides a huge market. But that's pretty much it. Otherwise, everything is done locally. The Russian Empire, people forget that Poland was completely and absolutely independent in every way, shape, manner, and form. It was a highly Judaized state within the Russian Empire that didn't even pay taxes half the time. I could say the same for Finland. These are empires. These are not countries. However, there's at least two different kinds of empires in his mind. I say this in the Third Rome as well. There's the commercial empire of the Portuguese or the Dutch or the British. Solonovich says that the British Empire is the most efficient instrument of exploitation that's ever existed in human history. Its whole purpose is to extract surplus value from its colonies and markets. It exists for the sake of profit for a handful. And of course, being a empire that's global, only a handful of oligarchs in the center could ever actually oversee that and profit from it. Small business owner had no ability to impact that. This is only tiny Darwinian, Spencerian oligarchy could have that impact. So it was oligarchic almost by definition. Then you had Russia and Germany, China maybe. You have an empire that's forced upon it. Russia is surrounded by enemies, always has been, is open on most fronts to foreign invasion. It requires buffer states. And that's really what the empire was. Russia didn't have colonies in Africa or Latin America. That wouldn't make any sense. It wasn't that kind of an empire. Outside of Ukraine, St. Petersburg lost money on the so-called colony. The colonies were mostly voluntary anyway, especially in places like Armenia and Georgia, being completely surrounded by Islam. And laws were enforced from Petersburg only in the breach. Having colonies is another way of saying investing in their defense spending. Russia had no choice but to develop into a more or less centralized society, a government, at least where it came to taxes and foreign policy and military. Ivan the Terrible created his Opichina. The largest it ever got was about 3,500 men. Elite noble armies were bigger than that. But its point was to function for the common good. The opposite being oligarchy, which is what they were facing. The major noble families in Renaissance Russia under Ivan the Terrible, they had their own currency. They had their own economies. They had large armies. They had their own intelligence services. They had navies in certain places. These powerful families had that those sort of resources at the elite level. So what do you do if you're the emperor? Really, the emperor of nothing at the time. You need to create your own court force that can be used to beat some of these guys into submission. And there's a good chance you're going to lose because they outnumber you. And yet, the church backed him. The ethnic nationalists, of course, backed him. The unity of the people ended up winning far more than the separatism of the oligarchs. Again, this is separatism not because they have some abstract concept of self-determination. This is because they don't feel like paying taxes anymore. Because cities like Novgorod, Pskov, even Tver, to a great extent, even Galicia maybe, because they were so oligarchic and hence constantly divided into factions based on financial concerns, because of that, they could never consolidate. They could never be the source of unity for anything. They were in no position to act as a foundation of what needed to be in order for Russia to continue to exist. The way he defines these terms, and I think we need to do this right now, He defines a nation as what happens when several closely related tribes create their own common way of life. A tribe is not big enough. It is far too vulnerable to be on its own. The only tribes that are going to work are those that are very closely related anyway. So you have an ethnic unit forming and slowly standardized language. And of course, you're only going to marry people whose language you speak. So very quickly, it becomes a genetic organization. The state, he defines as the nation in political form. So when the nation functions on the world stage or in economics or anything like that, the state acts as its protector and spokesman. The crown, and in this case he means monarchy as well as the actual religious concept of the crown, is the greatest and highest expression of unity within and in certain circumstances among nations. When it comes to empires, you seem to have two general types. You have those that are very ethnic, like in Russia. The Russian Tsar is a Russian institution, and certainly a Slavic institution. There are other nations within this empire, but they were completely left alone. They paid their taxes, and sometimes even if they didn't. It's not, it has a national foundation, very clear, blatant national foundation, and it's the majority of the population. You know, 75% of the Russian Empire were Slavic. By 1900. But then you have something like Austria, where you have no group that's a majority. Now you need to have a lingua franca at the center. The bureaucracy had to speak German. The military had to speak German. You can't have people barking orders in different languages. You know, like Rome and Latin. That has to be. That doesn't even imply, though, a single ethnic group. That's simply a matter of necessity. And if you come from Hungary and you want to work for the government, you better start speaking German. The problem with that is the emperor ends up being nothing more than someone who has to balance one faction against another. This is exactly how Austria-Hungary operated in the 19th century and before. Another way of putting it, though, is that because they don't have a dominant ethnic group, it is a religious institution. There aren't a whole lot of successful empires or states that had deep cleavages in religion. No nation exists that, I don't mean federations, I mean nations, exist with differences in religion. It had to be crushed in England, had to be crushed in France, and vehemently so in the 19th century in Germany. Because religion is the moral foundation of the people, you can't have Protestant and Catholic in the same place. They're completely different groups of people. The mentality, I mean, there's no such thing as a Protestant